Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Oren Rudofsky, writer, director, and producer of the NEH-funded American Masters documentary, Joseph Pulitzer, Voice of the People, set to broadcast this month, Friday, April 12th, on PBS stations nationwide. Adam Driver narrates the film. Liv Schreiber is the voice of Pulitzer. Tim Blake Nelson is the voice of Teddy Roosevelt. And Rachel Brosnahan is the voice of Nellie Bly. Oren Rudofsky also runs an award-winning New York-based film company which seeks to create documentaries and fiction films that examine what it means to be human. We'll talk with Oren Rudofsky about the new documentary and the rest of his life's work. But first, welcome, Oren Rudofsky.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be on the show. I've been hearing you on the radio for God knows how long.
Exactly right. It's long. It's been a long life so far.
Long, fun ride, yes.
It has been. Oren, tell me about yourself. Where were you born? Where were you raised? What were your parents like?
Oh, I was born in Champaign, Illinois, but we didn't stay there long. I was there for a year. My father is a rabbi and was the Hillel director at the university there, and then got a job in Cleveland. And I was in Beechwood, Cleveland, till the age of 7. And then I guess you'd call those the early formative years, and then Boston, Newton, Massachusetts, till I went to college in Oberlin, Ohio. So that's the first quarter, third of my life, I guess you would say.
How old are you now?
Oh, do you have to go there? I'm 62. I'm proudly 62.
You don't look it.
I now can get into the movies for senior rates, which is terrific.
So was your father a lifelong Hillel rabbi, or did he have a congregation?
No, he went on to congregational life. He was the assistant rabbi at Fairmount Temple, where there was a relatively well-known rabbi, Joseph Lullyveld, who was very involved in the civil rights struggle. And in 64, there was a famous photo, I think, in the New York Times with him bloodied from some rally he was at. So the progressive streak, I guess, was inherited by my father, and the desire to be involved in social justice issues and the desire to just be reading the newspaper also, which I was doing from a young age. My father, when we'd take car rides, he's from New York, and when we'd take the car ride back from Cleveland to New York to visit the grandparents, he would have me read from the New York Times from the back seat. And so that's part of how I got my education and love of newspapers.
It's a good way to do it. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned the name Lullyveld, because, of course, the New York Times had a very famous managing editor named Lullyveld. Any relation?
Joseph Lullyveld, yes. Well, my father was the bar mitzvah tutor for Joseph Lullyveld and in Cleveland. And then Joseph obviously went on to do great things, including not just his reporting life, but running the New York Times in the 80s and 90s.
Not to push it too long, because we want to do some other stuff here, but I taught at New Paltz for 40 years, and I'm sitting there one day. I'm invited because they have us visiting somebody, I forget who. And I'm sitting there, and we're all around, and there's Lullyveld sitting across the table from me, and there were several round tables, maybe three or four.
Right.
And I remembered very well, because at the Stephen Wise Free Synagogue, where I was bar mitzvahed, I was sitting. Uh-huh. I had promised Rabbi Klein, the famous Rabbi Klein, that I would stay on through confirmation, which they did in this particular synagogue. And sitting across from me was a Lullyveld.
Wow.
So I asked him. I started to talk to him. I said, "Were you bar mitzvahed?" He looks at me very strangely. He says, "Yes." And I said, "Well, were you confirmed at the Stephen Wise Free Synagogue?" He says, "Yes." And I said, "Well, did you meet once a week in Rabbi Klein's study with that confirmation class?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, I was there. I was right opposite you." And he said to me, "Nope, that was my younger brother," which is pretty funny. In any case, I had no idea what anybody in that class was talking about. They were all smarter than I was,
and I doubt it.
I just held on for dear life. Anyway,
we all did.
So talk to me about Pulitzer and how that came about. Why Pulitzer?
Well, Pulitzer is perhaps the greatest and perhaps most unknown American journalist and publisher out there. Everybody knows William Randolph Hearst and Citizen Kane, and obviously, yes, people know about the Pulitzer Prizes, but they know very little else except maybe some reference to yellow journalism, which is not as earned, I think, as that wouldn't be fairly the only two things to say about Joseph Pulitzer, because he's kind of a remarkable man and really transformed American media and was a role model for William Randolph Hearst when William Randolph Hearst was at Harvard. And yes, his father was running the San Francisco Examiner, but or Chronicle, I don't want to get that wrong. So Hearst was and is a remarkable American figure who I knew nothing about, and my co-writer Bob Seidman and a co-producer introduced me to Pulitzer. And when I started to read about him, especially this memoir written by one of his secretaries at the end of his life called Adventures with a Genius, I just was really taken with the man as a man, aside from his newspaper exploits.
I was fascinated by something that I did not know. I didn't know he was Jewish. I suppose I should have, but he was a Hungarian Jew.
I think he was in your bar mitzvah class, actually.
So on top of everything else, and as soon as you say we're all familiar with other publishers like the Hearsts, it is interesting that he comes as a Jew. Was there much anti-Semitism revolving around him ever?
Yeah, there was. And he was an educated young man. He came here. He was just trying to get out of Hungary. His eight of his nine siblings had died, and his father had died, and his mother had remarried to somebody he apparently did not like very much, and he had very bad eyesight, and he was trying to get into an army. He saw that as a way out, and recruiters from the Civil War were scouring Europe because rich men's children, sons, they didn't want them to go to fight in the Civil War because the mortality rates were pretty high. So they were scouring Europe for recruits, and they took Pulitzer. They'd take anybody. And he got here just towards the end of the Civil War and didn't really see much action. But he was part of a German-speaking unit called the Lincoln Brigade. And that's how he got here. But towards your question about being Jewish, I don't think he broadcast the fact that he was Jewish, but people knew he was Jewish because I guess people knew by the name. And he was caricatured viciously in the newspapers. He did have a big nose. People caricatured him, called him Joseph Pulitzer, Joseph Julitzer, and much worse things in the paper than we quoted, actually. But in the early years, you know, until the mass Jewish Eastern European immigration to the States beginning in the 1890s, anti-Semitism was at a relatively low ebb. It got much stronger when Eastern European Jews came to the country en masse. So that would be what I'd call the beginning of a... But compared to Europe, it was nothing. And there were not pogroms in the United States against Jews. There were lynchings against African Americans, but not pogroms against Jews, except for one case in the South. Leo Frank, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But Pulitzer certainly suffered from that. He did marry an Episcopalian girl, distant relation of Jefferson Davis from the Confederate side. But in general, you know, he did not bring his children up Jewish. He brought them up apparently Episcopalian. I don't know if he was much of a churchgoer. But, you know, so that part of who he was, he still, you know, I like to think that his politics, his progressive politics, come partially from his Jewish ethical upbringing and from the fact also perhaps that he was born in 1847 and there were revolutions across Europe in 1848 that were progressive revolutions. And that's the climate he grew up in.
It's interesting. He had a brother, and the brother and he yeah. had a history, right?
Yeah. They had a very bad history, and, you know, there's not as much detail about that relationship as one would like to characterize it completely. But his brother obviously was clearly perhaps as smart as Pulitzer. I think Pulitzer was a genius. He was a polymath. He learned languages very quickly. And his brother came many years later, not many, several years later, to the States and to St. Louis, where Pulitzer was. Pulitzer went there because there was a big German-speaking population there. And he came there and lived briefly with Pulitzer, and then I believe Pulitzer kicked his brother out. But Pulitzer's brother did good, and he himself became a rather successful publisher of a New York paper called The Morning Journal, which was known as the Chambermaid's Delight.
So another connection is that Pulitzer, being a Hungarian Jew, right?
Yes.
Yes. My wife's family were Hungarian Jews in the same period, maybe a little bit later, and they all ended up in, of all places, Hudson, New York, which is a fascinating sort of thing to associate the whole thing with. Anyway, I wanted to get to the nuts and bolts of what Pulitzer did. In other words, give us a little timeline on how it all happened.
Born in 1847, comes to America right at the end of the Civil War, then wanders around a little, is in New York, doesn't have a penny to his name, and can't get a job, and hears that there's a good community of German-speaking people in St. Louis, hops a train, gets there, and has a whole series of odd jobs, burying cholera victims, tending ornery mules, and at a certain point he gets taken for a ride on some boat where he thinks he's, this is not in the film, but he thinks he's getting a job, and he gets let out somewhere in the middle of nowhere. But he comes back with a story which he can tell and tells and writes a newspaper piece. And in those days, there was no professional way to become a newspaper man. You had to be able to tell a story. You had to be able to meet people and learn about them and report on them. And he is hanging out in St. Louis, and there's a place called the Mercantile Library, which is where apparently in towns across, cities across the country, young men would go to meet other aspiring business people and whatever. And there he met Carl Schurz, who was German leader of the 48 Revolution, which happened all over Europe and which were defeated. And he came to the States and became a Civil War general. And then in St. Louis, he became the owner of a German written newspaper called the Westliche Post. And he meets Pulitzer and immediately recognizes talent and hires him. And very quickly, Pulitzer gets offered the opportunity to buy a share of the paper and borrows money and does so. And then shortly thereafter, before the age of 21, he gets elected as a state legislator. And while he's working on the newspaper, and shortly after that, there's a paper called The Post and a paper called The Dispatch, and they're both going bankrupt, and he manages for barely any money to get a hold of both of them and create The Post-Dispatch, which, of course, becomes, you know, one of the most important papers in the United States. So he has a meteoric rise, quite extraordinary, and he does it because he likes to tell stories. He tells stories about tax dodgers in St. Louis, wealthy people who never expected their names to be in the paper for anything other than their parties and the marriages of their children. And here he is exposing wrongdoing, and he takes no prisoners. What he finds out, he prints it in the paper, and people want to read it. And, you know, he sends his reporters out to tell great stories. He's a reader of Dickens. That's supposedly how he learns to read English, is by reading Dickens. And he knows Dickens' storytelling methods. And those really are the methods he follows, I believe, throughout his career. He knows how to tell a good story, and he exposes wrongdoing. And then by 1883, he's married to Kate Davis, this beautiful Washington, D.C. socialite, and he's making money hand over fist through advertising. He understands that a newspaper, to be independent, you know, the whole economy of the country's changing. So there's department stores, and people are paying a penny for the paper, but through advertising, he's raking it in, to be honest. And he comes to New York and founds this newspaper that existed called the New York World. He recreates it as the World. And it becomes the most successful, largest circulation paper in the United States, if not the world.
Wow. We are talking to Oren Radofsky, who is responsible for a wonderful film, which I recently saw, a documentary on Joseph Pulitzer. So when the history of journalism is written, Pulitzer is a first, isn't he?
Well, there are a lot of newspapers. You know, we had a section in the film which we had to cut out, sadly, about the history of newspapers in this country. And Ben Franklin had a newspaper, and many politicians had newspapers. And newspapers were, in those days, very closely tied to politics, to politicians, to political parties, which is one thing that Pulitzer, to a certain degree, broke from, though he was always a progressive and in New York tied to some degree, well, which is unclear to me, to the Democratic Party, not in some hand and fist way. But there are newspapers. Ida Wells had a newspaper. There's a whole history of early newspapers used to be one sheets, which would, you know, tell about sales of a horse or something else and would be nailed. And one theory is the reason it's called the post is because the newspaper was nailed to the post, or it was nailed to something at the post office, or, you know, there are many theories, and I don't know which is correct about the name for the post being referred to for the newspapers. But there's a history of newspapers in the States, and his first experience, we say, and we believe, is of American newspapers is in the Civil War, where the listings of wounded and dead are of great importance, of course, to American families who want to know what happened to their children. And accuracy, the idea of newspapers being accurate, is perhaps tied to how important it would be not to misreport that kind of information.
Well, how accurate was he? In other words, did he make it up? Did he make it up, or was it accurate?
Well, you know, as we know from every newspaper or radio report, there are always some inaccuracies, and people get the facts wrong or they hear them wrong. But he did, in his New York office, have on the wall these big posters which said, you know, accuracy, accuracy, accuracy. He was a big believer in it, but the story goes that William Randolph Hearst came to town and started his own newspaper, actually bought the newspaper, the Morning Journal, that had been owned by Pulitzer's brother Albert, and he recreated it in the image of Pulitzer's paper. That was his hero. And they got into a competition, and Hearst had endless resources. His family, his father, made oodles of money in the mining, silver mining business, and could fund his son till the sun set. He had endless money, and Pulitzer and he engaged in circulation battles. And at the beginning of what became the Spanish-American War, there's a famous ship, the Maine, sure, which blew up. And nobody knew why it blew up, but Hearst wrote in his paper that the Spaniards had blown it up, had mined it and blown it up. There was absolutely no reason to believe this, but Hearst thought it would be a good story. Pulitzer's paper did not follow suit, but very quickly afterwards, it did join in the cry for war based on misinformation or unknown information. And so Pulitzer's paper, and the question is whether Pulitzer himself or his editors approved this or how it exactly happened. But regardless, he was the publisher and responsible for what it printed. And yeah, there were inaccuracies in the paper and a cry for war. And he later wrote in regret of this, and he tried to make amends for it. And he had already beforehand believed that newspapers had to be professionalized. And that's why he offered to fund a journalism school at Columbia in New York. And Columbia, you know, speaking of anti-Semitism, was ambivalent about taking the money. And one theory was they felt like they had enough Jewish money and they didn't want another building with a Jewish name on it. Another theory is that Pulitzer was just so difficult to deal with that it wasn't until he died that they opened the journalism school, notably not putting it in Pulitzer's name. However, the Pulitzer Prizes were also endowed through Columbia University and through the journalism school. And of course, they do carry Pulitzer's name, but that's another way that he believed newspapers served democracy. He was a big believer in the power of the press and the importance of the press and the importance of the news in a democracy. And he said, our republic and its press will rise or fall together. He also, in 1902, wrote about the question of fake news. And he understood the dangers of inaccurate reporting. And you know, I'm making this film in 2016, and, you know, who gets elected? And and denigration of the press, denigration of immigrants, fake news, all this stuff becomes our daily reading. And so suddenly this film about Pulitzer, which I thought was significant because journalism and newspapers are really struggling, and I thought it was important to tell the story of this remarkable journalist, suddenly it takes on all different hues and shades of what's going on today.
We're talking to Oren Radosky. Oren, as I say, I saw the film, and hope everybody will be tuning in on Friday, April 12th on PBS stations nationwide to see it, because it's really remarkable. So TR was in that war. How did TR get along with Pulitzer?
Yeah, I just want to say before I forget that it's part of the PBS American Masters series. T.R. came from New York, and he was a police commissioner, fire commissioner in New York. I think it's fire commissioner. I don't want to get that wrong. Accuracy. But we don't talk about that era, but apparently from the very beginning, he and Pulitzer had animosity because Pulitzer did investigative reporting, and he apparently, from the very beginning, he was giving T.R. a hard time. And yes, T.R. fought in the Spanish-American War, but the film focuses on their relationship later when T.R. was president, and the Panama Canal, or the idea of building a canal, which had been a French idea that was going to be built through Nicaragua, that never happened for a number of reasons, one of which was, for whatever reason, Nicaragua didn't want it. And so TR and business executives thought, well, if we can get some Nicaraguan soldiers to stage a civil war, we'll park our ships off the coast and give them tacit support. And that's how the Nation of Panama came into being, because they wanted to build the Panama Canal, TR and his cronies. And Pulitzer was very suspicious both about the colonial ambitions in his mea culpa after the Spanish-American War, and then with the acquisition of the Philippines and Puerto Rico and Guam afterwards, and then this basic creation of a country, and the fact that there was money from this French conglomerate that seemed to disappear. And he was in the paper tracking where this money went. And TR didn't like that. And it was never quite clear, or it's not clear to me. Some people say it is clear where this money went, or whether it went wrongfully into J.P. Morgan's pockets or other people's pockets. And I don't have the verdict on that. But there were a series of articles over a number of years. It was a drip, drip, drip. As we know from different eras, the Watergate era, that things don't happen overnight. And it's often because of newspaper reporting that things don't disappear. They often do disappear, and nobody finds out about wrongdoing. Well, Pulitzer kept at it. And TR got so angry that he insisted that Pulitzer be sued for criminal libel. There is no such thing in federal courts as criminal libel. But he nevertheless got his attorney general to take the case to the Supreme Court and vilified Pulitzer in language to the Congress and, you know, basically called him an enemy of the people and wanted to jail him. And Pulitzer, at the end of his life, he's blind, he's sickly, he's traveling back and forth on his yacht because he has an aversion to sound, and the only place where he feels peace and quiet, apparently, is on board this boat. and he takes on the president. He has six secretaries who travel with him constantly, reading from the newspaper, reading to him day and night because he can't sleep at night. He's a pretty miserable guy, unhappy guy, but he stays the course with this story and stays deeply involved with his newspaper to the very end and wins the Supreme Court case on all counts, which kind of speaks to the freedom of the press issue of the First Amendment. The case is thrown out on multiple grounds and doesn't hold water. And, you know, it's one of those cases that upholds the concept that the press can report stories and as accurately as they can, of course, is the idea.
So let's go back to the Pulitzer Prize for a moment.
Yes.
He gets involved with Columbia. Columbia obviously sets up the prize. Does he directly want that prize done, or how does that
work? Oh, yes. Yes. He endows, he gives $1 million, and he first tries to give it to them in 1899. $1 million for the building, and that's a long time ago, so $1 million goes a long way towards the building of the, or creation of the journalism school, which would have been the first in the country. It turns out that Missouri beats out Columbia by 1 year in building its own journalism school. But Pulitzer had the idea first, and he also endowed the prizes. I don't think he himself called them the prizes. I'm not sure that he called them the Pulitzer Prizes. And at his own newspaper, The World, and at the Post-Dispatch, he had internally prizes, which he gave to reporters. But notably, there were fewer prizes when the Pulitzer Prizes first began being handed out in 1915 under the auspices of the Columbia Journalism School. But it was his idea, it was his money, which endowed it. And the prize that mattered the most to him was community service, the newspaper's service to its community. And one of the first, just to go back in time, one of the first stories, crusades, which he did in his paper, had to do with the building of the Statue of Liberty, which was a gift from France to the United States, but it was given without a pedestal to stand on. And one of Pulitzer's first crusades was to crowdfund a pedestal by asking readers to give nickels, dimes, and pennies to build the pedestal, which Congress refused to fund. And what he did brilliantly was he put every single person's name in the newspaper, which led to people, of course, buying the newspaper, but also giving them credit. And it's exactly how crowdfunding is done today. He was 100 years ahead of his time in that regard. And he also created one of the most visually powerful and interesting papers in the country. And although he did not endow photography prizes, those became one of the key prizes that the Pulitzers started giving out. I think they started that in the 1930s, if I'm not mistaken, or it might have been later, so I don't want to get that wrong.
So he got to see the fruits of his money in the prizes, right? It didn't come.
No, he did not. Okay. He passed away in 1911, and the Jay School was founded in 1912. They waited until he died. And then the Pulitzer Prizes began in 1915. But his sons carried on the tradition, carried on The World and the Post-Dispatch. The Post-Dispatch is still alive today, and it was in the hands, direct hands of family, much like the New York Times is in the hands of the Oakes-Sulzberger family, and it was in the Pulitzer family hands till 2005, at which point they sold it just before the newspaper business really didn't completely collapse, but went through major contractions. So they got out at a very auspicious time. And Emily Pulitzer, who's the widow of Joseph Pulitzer IV, helped endow the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, which is in Washington, D.C.
Now, my mother used to walk in with the World Telegram and something else. It was all combined. I take it that was the World. That was
where
the
World. Yes, it was known as the Widget, the World Telegram Journal, or something
yeah,
like
right.
that.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. That was the end of the end of the day, sadly, because the world was kind of a remarkable amalgam of, you know, one could look at New York Magazine or the New Yorker. They had profiles like the New Yorker, and it was a precursor of many of today's newspapers. It had loads of stories and visuals the way you might describe, and comics. The Yellow Kid was one of the first comics, and people would buy the paper for that. And apparently, you know, he was a champion of immigrants. I don't want to leave that out. He was a great champion of those who lived on the Lower East Side, not just those who lived uptown. And he reported equally on rich and poor and exposed the terrible conditions that the lower class lived under. And also, he was known as a paper for immigrants. And he had many sections of the paper which were devoted to the kinds of things that immigrants might be interested in.
Just for the sake of clarity, it was the World Telegram and Sun, as I remember it. All of a sudden, my feeble brain has remembered that. Anyway, the response to this, is there anybody who's not going to like your film? I mean, I loved it. I thought it was great. Was anybody going to be insulted by it?
You know, there's always, any film you make, you can't cover everything. You can't tell the whole story. Some people object to the fact that I'm calling such a wealthy man a progressive. He wasn't, you know, a man ahead of his times in terms of empowering women or people of color. There are things you can criticize, of course. The question is it, to what degree is it fair to do so when you're talking about somebody who did uphold the poor and immigrants and did speak truth to power because he didn't do everything. And he didn't do everything. And he was vastly wealthy. And he was a man of many contradictions. And he didn't treat his newsies so well, especially when he was in competition with Hearst. And he was a good businessman. So, and people who don't believe in freedom of the press, well, they might not appreciate the film, and there are those out there who think the press has too much power. I frankly think the press, as much power as it has, it can't affect how laws are passed or how executive orders are played out. It has limited power.
As we are seeing now.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, what do you think Pulitzer would have done with Trump?
I think he would have been fighting him as hard as he could and trying to do what newspapers I respect try to do, which is to get the facts straight and to demand that things are backed up by accuracy, by scientific or, you know, by the best minds, I think he would have fought that battle. But I think what was amazing about Pulitzer is he really was up on the technology, and he found ways to report. And back in the day, he built at one time the largest, tallest building in New York, the World Building, which got torn down, sadly. But he would project on the building the results from elections, and people would stand out on the street and see by the color of what he would project on the building, they would know who was winning what race. He was way ahead of his time in trying to, you know, bring the news to the people. So he would have been fighting the good fight.
Okay, so we are talking with Oren Radofsky. He's a master filmmaker. They're going to show this film on Pulitzer as part of the Masters series.
American Masters
series. And it's going to be on April 12th on PBS stations nationwide. Since I've seen it, I can tell you it was wonderful. I actually paid money to go see it, you know. I want you to know that.
I appreciate that. Very little gets back to me, but I appreciate it nevertheless. And the Millerton Movie House needs it, so...
I love that Millerton Movie House. I love it.
Yeah, well, they really make an effort to bring documentaries and local programming and filmmakers to the movie house. So they're doing great work there. So I love going there and speaking when they show films.
As you probably know, they have two places upstairs and two places downstairs. But if you want to go upstairs, you got to climb a long, long staircase, and they're raising money. I think they may have raised it already for an elevator. What I love about it is somebody produced a wonderful short film for them showing two old guys coming in, getting their popcorn, and trying to get up that staircase.
It's hysterical. It's brilliant. And just the other day when I was showing the Pulitzer film up there, I literally saw that enacted by real people climbing very slowly up those stairs. I don't know if they've raised all the money they need, but they're working towards building a bit of a film community center there as well. Carol Sadlon has some big plans. Robert and Carol Sadlon own it, and they have some interesting plans for having additional programming there and film classes and other stuff. So she's up. They're up to interesting stuff.
Well,
there.
It's terrific. I just wanted to report to everybody that the film that these two old guys were trying to get up the stairs to see was Casablanca. And the last thing, as they get up to the top spot, the last thing you see is on the screen. He says, I guess this is the beginning of a long friendship, which, of course, is the last line.
Right.
You know, in the movie, it was
Claude Rains, it was
fabulous. It was just fabulous.
Claude Rains and Humphrey Bogart walking off into the fog at the airport. Yes.
So you're a documentary filmmaker. I keep meeting documentary filmmakers, and I can't figure how they make a buck. You know, in other words, how they survive. How does that work?
Well, it's not the best model for becoming an affluent person. It's very difficult. Of course, the means of production have gotten much cheaper. And if you're a young person and you don't have a family to support, you can make a film very cheaply. And you know, when I was much younger, I lived on rice and beans basically, and I got small grants. I was in Ohio. I went to Oberlin College and the Ohio Arts Council. My first documentary, which was about three mental patients who made animated films about their experience. Well, I got a $5,000 grant from the Ohio Arts Council, and I thought that was millions. And then got a little more money from the Nord Center and was able to make this first documentary, which got me hooked.
Was that while you were in college?
No, I went to Oberlin College. I wanted to be a progressive lawyer, like a William Kunstler.
Sure.
The Chicago Seven, and I wanted to support the farm workers, and I was involved but then I realized I wouldn't be a very good lawyer, and I was interested, and I was a photographer, and I loved films. I thought I would make fiction films, and I didn't really know what documentaries were. But then I got this opportunity to make this documentary film about real people, and I realized that, you know, giving voice to the voiceless became my cause. And ironically, even though Pulitzer's world famous and whatever, I think it's still in the same school because people don't know much about him. So I still think I'm giving voice to the voiceless. But yeah, it's you know, now I apply to places like the National Endowment for the Humanities, which is one of the few sources where an independent filmmaker can get a serious chunk of change, and pay myself a little salary. And American Masters gave me additional funds, and good people out there who have helped. The Carnegie Corporation got involved. Scott and Roxanne Bach, who are locals up here in Lakeville, helped out a little bit. And so, you know, you piece together your funds for the film, and occasionally documentaries get extremely lucky and can make some money. You know, Hoop Dreams is an old version of that. RBG, the Ruth Bader Ginsburg film, has done extremely well. Free Solo which is more of a popular entertainment, has as well. So, you know, but people make these films because they're often just very committed to telling untold stories and getting them out there. And yes, everybody needs to make a living, but, you know, no, I'm not getting rich.
No, okay, but I guess I wanted to just take that a little bit further and ask you this. We hear all the time, I hang around a lot of politicians, and they spend all their time raising money. And my inbox and my email is just huge with everybody from Nancy Pelosi. You name them, they're all asking for money. Okay, so I take it that a good deal of your life is involved in having to find some money to help you produce these films.
That is absolutely true. You know, sometimes people pay for films. I made a film recently. Well, this was also, no, I'm wrong, but I did not. Sometimes I don't have to do the fundraising. Uh-huh. I just made a film called Witness Theater, which is going to be coming out, which is about a group of Holocaust survivors and high school students involved in a year-long workshop where in the end they put on a play, and I love this film. It's a very emotional film, and I was involved in making it with the organization called Self Help, which helped, in this case, raise the funds to make the film. So occasionally, you know, you find people who will fund a film, or of course, Netflix is now making documentaries, HBO, Amazon, and others, but it's hard to crack into that very rarefied world. So you know, there are some European sources also, but yes, a good deal of my time is spent either writing grant applications or asking people who I think might have a strong interest in a subject in making a film.
And have you found that as you got more successful, it became a little easier based on your reputation to get that money?
Yes and no. Yes, absolutely. People trust that when they give me money, that I'm going to make the film and I'm going to make a good film.
It's going to get done. Yeah.
Absolutely. Because it's hard to, you know, there's some films that are nearly done that just can't get over that hump. And I'm very proud of the fact that virtually every film I've made, except one, which was about a Mexican immigrant coming to this country and getting killed on a construction site. But that's the one film I haven't managed to get fully funded. So if anybody's out there who wants to help me, please do. But I've made over, I can't count them anymore. It's over 20 films.
Wow.
I've made a fiction film, which, you know, fiction films obviously can make a lot of money, but most of them don't. So it's a better business model, perhaps. But, you know, and I'm always working on a bunch of different project ideas, some of which are fiction ideas. But yes, people trust you more. You have a track record. That helps. But it doesn't necessarily, people don't just hand you the money. They want to know what you're going to do, why you're going to do it, how you're going to do it. Very rarely, there's probably one or two or three filmmakers in the world who can just say, hey, I've got a great idea. I can't tell you about it. Give me the money. You know, that doesn't happen very free, even in Hollywood, and that doesn't happen anywhere.
So tell me about Oberlin. You've mentioned it three or four times. Obviously, it was important to you. I have a lot of friends who went there. Did you come away with something that you think was a big part of what you've been able to accomplish?
Well, Oberlin's motto is learning and labor. And Oberlin, I guess I have brought it up a lot because, first of all, my daughter's graduating from there in a month.
Legacy.
So it's she got there on her own brains and whatever. But I guess because I made my early films there out of Ohio, I stayed on in Ohio for several years. Working on a film about police brutality, a film about the Amish, a film about these mental patients I mentioned. So I have a lot of warmth in my heart for Ohio, even though it voted the wrong way in 2016. I still believe in Ohio, and I and the people of Ohio, and Oberlin's at the core of that. Just I created a wonderful community there, and some of the people I made my earliest films with, I met there, and so I guess. And as mentioned, you know, I also grew up a little bit in Cleveland, so Ohio has been a part of my life. I'm going there to show both the Pulitzer film and the Witness film at the Cleveland International Film Festival. So, and Oberlin is a progressive place that's ahead of its times, and
indeed,
some people denigrate it, and I think it's absolutely wrong. Some of the articles I've read in recent years about, anti-Semitism at Oberlin or stuff like that, it's just all not true. And my daughter's there, and I know that it is a community which likes to talk about politics and shares in ways that I wish happened more in this country.
Well, Oren Radofsky, we're almost out of time. I was fascinated by one of your films, Hasidism in America, was broadcast on PBS and ITVS, and you have a lot of others that people are going to want to know about. Is there a place they can go to find out more about you?
Yeah, well, A Life Apart is the name of that film. I have a website, orenrudofskyproductions.com, and this present film, Joseph PulitzerFilm.com, is a place to find out about the Pulitzer film. You can find out about them there, and a lot of them are available on Amazon and or streaming on various sites. And occasionally you can sadly find films that people have pirated and put on YouTube. So you can find them that way. But some of my favorite films of mine are A Life Apart, Hasidism in America, and a film called Hiding and Seeking, and Colliding Dreams about the Middle East conflict and the history of Zionism, and more, you know, and the recent ones, Witness Theater and Joseph Pulitzer, Voice of the People.
Well, let me just say it's a great pleasure to have you with us. We're honored that you've spent this time with us. Aaron Radofsky's work is well known now, and we certainly hope that this will not be the last time you come on and talk to us, and we appreciate it very much.
Thank you. I love the interview. You've done good, Alan. You know what you're doing, it seems. Thank you.
I try to let the other guy talk. We'll be seeing you, and again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store. Thank you.